From WBEZ Chicago, this is Nerdette.
I'm Greta Johnson.
And I'm Trisha Bobita. And today we are celebrating the 150th episode of Nerdette.
Woo! I feel like I should have a kazoo or something.
Oh, or a vuvuzela.
Yeah, exactly. We need vuvuzelas.
We're making a big deal out of the 150th episode because we kind of forgot to do anything about the 100th episode.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. We were busy, guys.
But we wanted to do something really special for the sesquicentennial.
How are you doing?
Good. I forgot how much that hurts.
Yeah, it sucks.
Yeah, that's Greta getting a tattoo.
Yeah, that's pretty horrible.
Yeah.
Is it happening, Greta?
And since
it
we're
sure
co-hosts
is.
And we do most, if not everything, together, this also happened.
Oh, that's not so bad.
No, I mean, it's horrible, but it's also like...
Yeah.
It's annoying, but bearable.
Yeah.
That's a good way to say it.
And that's me getting my tattoo. My first ever tattoo.
Yeah, it's actually not so bad. I thought it was going to hurt worse than this, she says prematurely.
It is worth noting that we didn't get, like, the Nerdette logo tattooed onto our faces or anything really intense like that.
No, that's for the 300th episode.
300? Okay, I guess maybe by 300 I'll be ready for that.
Also, I have to read this disclaimer that we got from our legal department.
Yeah, this is important.
Okay. Chicago Public Media does not endorse nor reimburse tattoos or affiliated tattoo acquisition activities heretofore and in perpetuity. The activities of the date in question, henceforth known as Tattoos Day, are the sole responsibility of Trisha Bobita and Greta Johnson exclusively. Got that out of the way.
Thank you, Trisha, for that disclaimer. That's very important.
Very legal.
So as I mentioned, we did not, in fact, get Nerdette logos tattooed onto our faces, but we both did get pretty nerdy tats.
Yeah.
I actually got like a mathematical representation of particle collision on my shoulder blade. And what'd you get, Trisha?
Okay, since you asked, I'll tell you about my tattoo. It's a circle with, inside it, the written language of Gallifrey, which is the planet the Doctor is from in Doctor Who. So this is a Doctor Who-themed tattoo.
Mm-hmm.
But what it says is my dad's favorite saying, which is very important to me, which is, consider the source, which as a journalist I find helpful, but also as a person. Taking a minute, always, to think about why someone is saying what they're saying.
So yeah, they are different tattoos, but they're both pretty nerdy, and I feel like they both involve a fair amount of lines and squiggles.
And at the end of today's episode, you will get to hear my mother's reaction to finding out about my first tattoo.
Oh, I always love to hear from Marcia. But first, our interview for this week is with Jill Tarter. She is an astronomer and the former director of SETI, which is the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Essentially, what these guys do is use huge satellites and point them out into outer space and listen for aliens.
They're listening really hard at space to try to see if anyone's trying to make contact, which is actually the name of the Carl Sagan book from 1985 that Jill Tarter inspired with her real-life science. In the book, you know, they find aliens and it's kind of awesome.
Yeah, that part's not quite
that part
true.
Hasn't happened to Jill Tarter yet. It hasn't happened yet.
Uh-huh.
She's played by Jodie Foster in the movie version of Contact that came out 20 years ago. And if you're like me and you've ever wondered if we are alone in the universe, then you need to listen to this conversation because Jill Tarter is going to explain to us what will happen if and when we make contact with aliens. How did you first get your start with SETI, and why was this something that was a question that you wanted to spend a career trying to answer?
Well, SETI itself was a bit of an accident. I did an undergraduate degree in engineering physics, decided, and please, this is not true today, but it was true then, decided at the end of 5 years, if engineers are as boring as my professors, I'm going to use these really good skills that I've acquired to go find interesting problems. And I ended up in astronomy, in astrophysics. My first year as a graduate student, I was hired as a research assistant to program the world's first kind of desktop computer, the PDP-8/S. Personally, I always thought the slash S stood for stupid, because this machine had 64,000 bytes of memory.
Wow.
And it had 11 instructions and no language. So you programmed it in Octal. Years later, I was still a graduate student, and this machine was obsolete, given to an X-ray astronomer, Stu Boyer, who had had a very clever idea about how to use UC Berkeley's radio telescope to do SETI at the same time the radio astronomers were doing their traditional research. But he had no money. So he went begging, and somebody gave him this old computer. And he said, what do I do with this? And they said, you know, Jill, she's down there. She's still here. Why don't you go talk to her? And he did. He came and recruited me to work with his project. And I was just overwhelmed. I learned that after millennia of all of us asking the priests and the philosophers what we should believe about this very important old question, are we alone? That suddenly, in the middle of the 20th century, we developed these tools that would allow scientists and engineers to actually do an exploration, to try and answer the question, to find out what is, rather than what somebody tells us we had to believe. And I was hooked. I mean, I thought, wow, I'm in the right place, the right time, I have the right tool and skills. I'm going to go for this. And I did, and I have.
You've mentioned elsewhere that we're such a young technology. The amount of time that we as humans have been able to listen and to look and to measure has been really not much time at all. And even in just the last 20 years since the film Contact first came out, I wonder, you know, what progress has been made in what SETI can do and what other researchers can do when it comes to those tools you're mentioning.
All right, let me see if I can give you an analogy that quantifies how little, right? If you're looking for signals and that's all you're looking for, and that could be the wrong thing. There might be something else that we should be doing, but we haven't invented that technology yet. But if you're looking for electromagnetic signals, then the haystack you have to search through is nine-dimensional. Three dimensions of space, one of time, two senses of polarization, what kind of modulation scheme, and lastly, you don't know how far away the transmitter is or how strong it might be, so you don't know how sensitive you have to be in your search to be successful. Nine dimensions. All right. Wrap that all up, that cosmic haystack, and say the volume of that space we want to search is equal to the volume of Earth's oceans. And we've been searching for 50 years, and we've been trying to make better tools to do the searching. So how much of that ocean have we explored? And the answer is essentially one 12-ounce glass of the ocean. All right. Now, if your experiment was, I wonder if there are any fish in the ocean. I'm going to do this experiment. I'm going to take a 12-ounce glass. I'm going to dip it in and look to see if I've caught any fish. If you didn't catch a fish, I don't think you'd be likely to conclude there are no fish in the ocean. Maybe you'd conclude that you need to start dipping a lot more glasses, a lot faster, and bigger glasses. And that's where we are today. And fortunately, the improvement in computer technology is able to give us an enormous exponential step up here so that our glasses really are getting bigger. Even though it's a big ocean, I'm really excited to begin an exploration.
When did you first find out that Carl Sagan was writing this book and that you might find one of the characters in some way familiar?
Well, Carl was a colleague, and I was at a meeting that Carl also attended, and he said, come on up to the house. We're going to have a cocktail party tonight. So I went, and he and Annie took me over aside, and they said, Carl's writing a science fiction book. And I said, oh, come on. The New York Times told us last weekend how much money he'd gotten as an advance for this book, and we are jealous as hell. Right? It's just amazing. And they laughed, and then Anne said, well, yeah, there might be somebody you think you recognize in the book, but I think you'll like her. I just shrugged it off, and I said, oh, look, as long as she doesn't eat ice cream cones for lunch, then nobody who knows me is going to think that that character is me, so fine.
Tell me more about these ice cream cones
for a minute. Oh, these ice cream cones. We were working at NASA Ames Research Center. It was an old naval base, and not much in the way of amenities. It did have a cafeteria, but it was cafeteria food. But it had a Baskins and Robbins on it. And so my colleagues and I would take a hike, right? It was quite a hike, but it was good exercise. And so we would have ice cream for lunch every day.
Yeah, you smooth out the long walk and the ice cream, and it's a wash.
It just works pretty, hand-ready food. You don't have to sit around and eat it there. You can take it with you. So it was a perfect solution for lunch at that place.
So the book comes out, and then later on the film comes out. And I wonder what you think the film Contact was able to do for young people's interest in astronomy? What role did it play?
Well, I think it was very impactful. When they started out, Warner Brothers had this as one of their goals. They wanted to increase interest in STEM fields, particularly by young women. And I'm not sure that they ever kept any formal metrics so that I can't quantify it. But I do know from personal experience that film's been out there now long enough so that I am frequently the recipient of comments like, that film was so important. That film was what changed my mind. That film was what made me become a scientist. So I know it's out there. And that's an interesting phrase. That effect is there. I can't quantify it for you, but it's certainly in my life something I see all the time. And it's great. We should do more of it.
Coming up, what would happen if SETI actually found a signal from another alien civilization?
You're listening to Nerdette. If SETI picks up a reading, intercepts a signal, what, to your estimation, would that chain of events really look like? How much evidence would you need to have to be sure enough to throw a flare up and get attention? How much evidence do you think it would take to convince others to take it seriously?
Well, for the programs that we have running at the SETI Institute, we have a set of protocols that we think we will go through. We have had a few false positives that have started us down those steps. The longest one lasted sort of 24 hours, and we never got to the stage where you call up the director of an observatory to the west who has the right frequency coverage and you say, could you discreetly take a look and tell us what you see? Because one of the things we worry about a lot is a hoax. We're a very attractive opportunity for hoaxes, and we want to make sure that someone using equipment that we didn't build and software that we didn't write can confirm independently our results. And then once you get an independent confirmation, you want to, as quickly as possible, arrange that the discovery information gets sent out to every observatory in the world. There's a thing called an IAU telegram system that we would use to alert every observatory to something that may be time critical because we have no idea how long this signal might be there. And you get all your colleagues looking at this area of the sky with whatever instruments they choose to employ to see what else might be there. And then you start, you know, fill in the blanks and get a paper off to a journal. And then you begin the list of who will get attribution for all of this. You want to make sure that you plan a press conference in which all of the many people involved are appropriately recognized. And you tell the world, because this information is not the property of the SETI Institute or any other discovery group. It's the property of humankind. What I've just described takes a lot of time. And we hope that if it is our telescopes that are involved with the discovery, we hope that we will have that time to work quietly and quickly to try and build this evidence base for an extraordinary discovery and announcement. But we know from experience. In that case, with the longest lasting false positive that we had, within 24 hours, our offices in California were getting called by the New York Times asking what was going on. And nobody deliberately called them. It was just a series of coincidences that meant someone could deduce that we were actually tracking a signal and were interested in it.
Reminds me of one of my favorite Mark Twain quotes, which is, three people can keep a secret if two of them are dead.
I think that's about it. Yeah. So we have these plans, and we spent a lot of time trying to make them up in the first place and then improve them as we've screwed up going along with false positives. but it's not clear that we'll get to use them.
Right now, SETI and many others are focused primarily on listening. And I wonder what you think about the balance of time and energy spent developing better ways of listening versus broadcasting.
Well, if there are other technological civilizations in the galaxy, I think it's probably pretty obvious that we are among the absolute youngest in terms of communicating across interstellar distances. We're talking 100 years at the maximum that we've been able to do anything that would be of interest. And that's actually very generous. And that's 100 years out of a 10 billion year history of the galaxy. And given that perspective, I think it makes sense for the young technology, the emerging technology, that's what we are, to listen first and see what's out there. But as time goes on, if we fail to detect a signal, and if we begin to become an older, advanced technology ourselves and can manage the considerably more difficult job of transmitting, not only is it energetically more costly, but if you're going to transmit, you have to sort of start and you never stop. Because if you transmit for 5 minutes, then your signal is going to be visible by any potential recipient for that 5 minutes. And they have to be looking at you in exactly the right way, at exactly the right time, when that signal comes whipping past at the speed of light. So if transmitting is taken seriously, it needs to be done for a long time. And whereas, you know, we get through our weekly planners and our sometimes 2 or 5 year plans, we haven't done squat with respect to 10,000 year plans. We're just not old enough yet to do that. So when we're young, we listen. When we get old and have the capability, then I think we should. And we should do so for the benefit of technologies out there who are emerging behind us.
Stephen Hawking, others have said maybe it's not such a good idea to invite extraterrestrials to interact with us, because think about what happened when Columbus landed, this idea of being colonized or being just sort of ripped apart for resources.
Eaten for breakfast.
But you seem to have a very different sense of, if we're able to listen and find intelligent life elsewhere, it might be beyond wanting to eat us for breakfast by that point. Is that fair to say?
Yes. Yeah. Now, Stephen Hawking is a pretty smart guy. And there are others who have this same concern that he does. But I look at it and I say, well, they're coming here. And if they can do that, they are older and technically far more advanced than we are. And I sit here and I wonder if it's possible to become an old, advanced technology without taking care of business back home, without managing to outgrow the aggressiveness that may well have had a part in the evolution of their intelligence. It certainly seems to have had in our case. And if they're an advanced technology with the capability to actually manage their civilization and steward their planet, I think what we have to offer is uniqueness and information and the ways in which we are different than every other species that they have encountered out there. So I'm not quite sure they're going to be sons of bitches and we have to run and hide. I mean, it may be that everybody at home is wonderful and they kick the sons of bitches out and they're the ones that come and find us. I don't know. I just think maybe to think about what it means to be a truly old technology might not lend itself to an analogy where we make them just as bloody and mean and aggressive as we are.
Just recently, Stephen Hawking has brought up again that he really thinks people ought to get their act together and start finding a new planet for us to live on, because we're not treating this one very well. and put a 100-year goal on that. What do you think's behind that idea? Is it time to look elsewhere?
Well, it's a long way to elsewhere, even though we know that the nearest star to us, Proxima Centauri, actually has a planet in the habitable zone of that star, which is fantastic for the scientists because that star, Proxima Centauri, is a little M dwarf star, teeny pipsqueak compared to our sun, doesn't give out a lot of energy, and the planet to be at a temperate place has to be really close to the star to keep warm enough. And we wonder about whether planets around M stars can retain their atmospheres if they had any. And so it's superb that we have all these questions and Mother Nature's given us a sandbox to play in right in our backyard. But having said that, right in our backyard is still 4 light years away, and one should not underestimate the difficulty of getting 4 light years away when we haven't even yet gotten to Mars. So it's good to be worrying about the next 100 years. It's also true that we don't actually have the knowledge base to necessarily be asking the right questions about what we need to do to get us through those 100 years. But I think we can't not try something. There are just this long list of existential questions that we've got to find a way to grapple with. And not doing something is not an option. We should take actions in ways that allow us to look for the short-term feedback and make corrections if we can, but also to take actions with a future in mind that isn't the tip of our nose. This longer look at the future and thinking about hundreds of years from now, what are the consequences of our actions, and try and drive those in the right direction.
After the break, we have some very serious thinky homework from Jill Tarter.
You're listening to Nerdette. One last question for you, Jill. What homework would you like to assign to our Nerdette listeners?
My homework would be go look at all your social media profiles. And what's the first thing you say about yourself? I would like that first thing to say that you say about yourself is that you're an earthling. And I would like you to try and follow that with an open, larger perspective, a more cosmic perspective about who you are, where you are, and how you fit into a much larger universe. Because I think it's that kind of perspective that's going to allow us to get through these next 100 years and to find answers to challenges that don't respect national boundaries right now, that have to be worked as global problems.
Excellent homework. I will do this homework. I will do that today. I'm going to go and change the first sentence on all of my online profiles.
Good. Maybe
earthling.
We can start a meme.
Sounds good. Jill right. Tarter, thanks so much for joining us on Nerdette.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, Trisha, it's time to tell us about what happened when you told your mom about your tattoo.
So I didn't tell her about it before it happened or as it was happening or afterwards because for some reason I was nervous to tell her about it because I've never gotten a tattoo before.
Sure.
So I decided it would be easier if she got to see it
totally.
As I told her about it instead of just hearing about it because then she might have envisioned it being sort of
on your face
intense or on my face, I guess. I don't know what I was worried about. But I was worried about it a little bit, so I waited until I went home. So I hopped off an Amtrak train. She picked me up. I got in the car and decided to just roll up my sleeves and show her.
Okay. Here, I want to show you what Greta and I did for our 150th episode of Nerdette. It's a tattoo.
What is it?
It's Gallifreyan, which is the written language of Doctor Who, and it says, "Consider the source."
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, Trisha.
So, yeah. Here,
it says, consider
light?
The shores? Yeah, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's so cool.
I'm glad I got one, too. We went together and recorded it.
So it's going to be an episode?
Yeah.
Oh, consider the source. I just said that to somebody the other day.
I know. It's a good saying, right?
Okay, but don't get any more.
All right.
No more. None.
I'm not going to get any more. Okay. I wanted one. Okay. And we got it for our 150th episode.
That's fine. No, that's fine. Yeah. Just don't, I like that it's consider the source.
It's consider the source, and it's, you know, pretty simple, and I can keep it covered whenever I want.
That too.
It's a good saying. And I like it because I know exactly what it says.
But not everybody
knows what it says. They just think it's a design.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Or they think it's satanic or something.
They're not going to think it's satanic.
It's in a good spot.
Yeah, it's in a good spot. My CEO says it's elegant.
The show is produced by us, Trisha Bobita and Greta Johnson, along with Candace Mattel.
Our executive producer is Joel Meyer, and our intern is Brady Guy.
Subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, follow us on NPR One, or you can listen to us on the WBEZ app.
One way you can be really helpful to Nerdette is by helping spread the good word by giving reviews. Give us all the stars
wherever you can.
Thank you to Kimbot83 and Dr. Cindy Lou 77 for giving us such nice reviews on Apple Podcasts. I like to think that Dr. Cindy Lou is Cindy Lou Who from Whoville, from Dr. Seuss, and she grew up to be a doctor after that really eventful childhood with the Grinch.
You know what's funny is I saw that and I was just like, this is a very random assortment of letters, but I guess that just says
where I am in my day.
I know, man. I know.
Dr. Cindy Lou likes Nerdette because she's like a doctor and a Whovian. Whoville Whovian? Does she like
Whovian.
Dr. Who?
Oh.
And, oh no.
Well,
I've
maybe
created
she'll
a labyrinth
us.
Of Dr. Seuss and Dr. Who.
Dr. Who's?
Dr. Who's.
Is that like House, though? Is that just Canadian House? Is Dr. Who's?
Yes. Starring Hugh Laurie with a weird accent. Find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Nerdette Podcast.
Our music is by Poddington Bear.
Do your homework.
Do your homework.
Okay, Candace, the producer, turn your microphone on. Before we settled on the idea of getting tattoos...
Yeah, we brainstormed a lot of different ideas. We thought about, like a hot air balloon ride or something?
Yeah, we considered that.
But it also became
very
clear.
Be easy, also wouldn't pay for
that.
Yeah,
they weren't going to pay for anything. So we had Candace, our math major producer, come up with some fun facts about the number 150.
Okay, 150 is a really cool number. First of all, 150 is the sum of 8 consecutive primes.
Jill Tarter would like that.
Yeah, this is, the prime thing.
Yeah,
the
primes are special, and it's really cool. 7, 11, 13, 17, 19, 23, 29, and 31 add up to 150. Okay, moreover, Euler's totient function over the first 22 integers is 150.
Wait, what?
So Euler's totient function, Euler is spelled E-U-L-E-R, by the way.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, some people say Euler,
yeah,
but it's Euler.
I might have said Euler.
Euler.
Euclid.
Euler.
You know.
Okay, but more importantly...
totient. Sorry, go on, Candace. We're listening.
Okay, so the totient function...
Annoying but bearable. That's what we are. Just like tattoos. Go on.
You guys are probably really good math students, I can tell.
Nope.
I was actually a decent math student for the record.
I just said no so with such vigor that I lost my headphones. I'm a nerd about all the things, but not the math.
Okay, but this is going to be exciting because Euler's totient function counts the positive integers up to a given integer that are relatively prime to that integer. So if you count all of the totient functions from 1 to 22, which I did because I saw that it was 150, but I wasn't convinced, so I did it this morning.
You tested it out.
You did your homework?
And I counted these, and it's 150.
Wait, can I see it?
So not only is that special, but like 22 is kind of special because it's over the first 22 integers.
Mm. Wow. So we could have just done this for a 22nd episode.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
Wow.
Okay, I have some other non-math facts.
Oh, good.
Okay. In June 2015, a 150-year-old tortoise died at the San Diego Zoo.
Oh.
Okay.
I'm sad
that's not
that
a fun
2 years
fact.
Ago.
Sorry.
Fun fact. Okay. 2 years ago, a turtle died.
Okay, real fun fact.
Uh-huh.
Exactly 150 years ago today was a Sunday.
All right.
Oh.
It's more fun than a turtle dying, so in that way it's a fun
that's
fact.
True. And, I mean, it is pretty crazy that we can know what day of the week happened 150 years ago, I suppose.
Yeah, in 1867. Okay, also in 1867. Okay, so 150 years ago this month, the Austro-Hungarian Empire was formed.
Hmm.
And,
Yeah, what else? What else
there's finally a really good one. There's a good one to end on. I forgot.
Oh, I hope you're right. You seem really excited.
Okay, finally, 150 is Dunbar's number. Okay, so there's this professor of evolutionary anthropology at the University of Oxford named Robin Dunbar. And he says, or his calculations say, that humans can only maintain a network of 150 close friends. Like, your brain can only handle 150 meaningful relationships in your mind at a time.
I actually love that. This makes me want to, like, delete a bunch of Facebook friends.
But really, 150. Like, That's a nice dinner party sized amount of friends.
Right, right.
Well, I think you don't have to be friends with all those people, but that's the sweet spot for, like, the number of people in your life you can associate with. And that number goes back to, like, hunter-gatherer societies where 150 was the magic
the
number.
The size of your clan?
Yeah.
All right. I mean, those are pretty fun facts about numbers. I think my favorite is the one where you just did a lot of math.
The Euler-Totient forum theorem.
Function.
I knew it started with an F and it wasn't the word forum.
Thanks, Candace.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks, Candace. Here's to 150 more.